mission trip interest meeting. So we're continuing today in Proverbs, and we're going to be in chapter 3 today. You can open up your Bibles and turn there if you want. And Proverbs chapter, we're going to start in a little bit in verse 13. But in the book of Proverbs, we've said this before, that the book of Proverbs is like a father sitting down his son and giving wisdom to his son. And he's saying to his son, like, this is how life works, instilling wisdom into his kids. So if you have a dad like that, be thankful. If you don't have a dad like that, you can be thankful for Proverbs. This is why God has given us this book to study. Now, this first verse, this the key verse of the whole book, is chapter 1, verse 7, where it says, the fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge. Fools despise wisdom and instruction. That is, if there's a verse that you need to remember, that's the key verse for the whole book, because it is like the keystone for the entire book of Proverbs, because it draws us back to this idea that we need to fear God, worship God, revere God, and that's where wisdom begins. We can't look at the book as just, it's just good advice, or give me some pointers on how I can get better at stuff in life. That's not what it's about. It's all about fearing God and worshiping him and revering him in a worshipful way. And that's what chapter 1, verse 7 is about. Now, sometimes I think we imagine Christianity like this: sacrifice now, blessing later. And we often put the blessing part, like in eternal life, in heaven one day. And we forget that blessing, God often has blessing for us now. And so there's truth to the idea that the Christian life is often, you know, sacrifice now and blessing later. But there are still some blessings that we obtain, I think, in this life. And Proverbs, I think, chapter 3 shows us this. Look at verse 13, where it says, blessed is the one who finds wisdom and the one who gets understanding. For the gain from her, when you see her in these verses, not referring to a person, it's referring to this, it's wisdom personified. This is Lady Wisdom he's talking about. For the gain from her is better than gain from silver, and her profit better than gold. She, meaning Lady Wisdom, is more precious than jewels, and nothing you desire can compare with her. Long life is in her right hand. In her left hand are riches and honor. Her ways are ways of pleasantness, and all her paths are peace. So the first idea we see here is this: is that wisdom should be sought after. You've got to seek after it. Now, you don't just stumble into wisdom accidentally. I've never met someone that says, yeah, I just happened upon this piece of wisdom, and I just did it accidentally. It's usually you've got to seek it out and pursue it, and we do that by praying for it. We search for it in God's word. We search for it in community with other people. We can read and listen to what others have to say. And so we've got to seek out wisdom. It's to be sought after. We don't just happen upon it or just stumble into it. And we see here that it says wisdom is more valuable than all the things that we value in this world. Now, many of you guys know this. I'm from the Washington, D.C. area. And so when I was a kid, one of the highlights for me was I loved going and visiting the city when I was a kid, and we would do it on field trips. So we would have the coolest field trips. We would go into the city, and we'd often go to, like, the Smithsonian as a field trip, and then we'd be back home for dinner at night. And we'd go to the Museum of Natural History in downtown D.C., and one of the highlights of going into that museum was this really amazing piece of jewelry called the Hope Diamond. And it's one of the largest blue diamonds in the world. I think it is the biggest blue diamond in the world that they have found. And you get an idea, it's about that big around, the diamond itself. And it's got this interesting story behind it, because in the 1600s, there was this French gem merchant who went to India. And I don't know the guy's name, but he saw this diamond sitting in the statue of a Hindu goddess, and he stole it. He grabbed it out of the eyeball of this Hindu goddess. He stole it. He takes it back to France, and he sells it to King Louis XIV. And then after that, it was owned by King Louis the 16th. And then it was owned by Marie Antoinette. You may have heard of her. And then it was stolen again during the French Revolution in 1792. And then around 1812, it resurfaces in London somewhere. And it was then later owned by this guy named Henry Philip Hope, where it got its name. Then it was passed down within his family. And then it was eventually sold to an American buyer. And then in 1958, this family donates it to the Smithsonian. Man, junior high is going crazy over there. They need to calm it down over there. And it is 45 carats, all right? So just for the word to the guys, like if you buy your future wife a diamond, it's not going to be 45 carats. Most likely not. Much smaller than that. And you'll learn these measurements later on when you have to understand jewelry at some point. But any idea how much this diamond is worth today? It is up there, way up there. It is worth $350 million if you were to sell it today. It's insanity. Now, how would you feel if someone sold it and they came to you and said, guess what? I sold the Hope Diamond and I'm going to give you the proceeds. Now, how would you feel at that point about your life? You would be set financially for the rest of your life. Your grandkids would be set financially for the rest of their lives. You could have anything you want if this were to happen to you. But as great as all that sounds, Proverbs says that wisdom is more valuable than jewels like this. It's hard to wrap our minds around that concept. That as much as that would change your life, if someone gave you the proceeds of that diamond, that wisdom will change your life in greater ways, in ways that you can't even fathom, is what wisdom, how wisdom can affect your life. Another example of this is just how people pursue gems and precious metals like this. Our nation's history is shaped by the seeking of precious metals, like gold. So in 1848, gold was discovered in California, kicking off this massive California gold rush, which peaked in 1849. That's why they call the team the 49ers today. And people begin pouring into California. Around 300,000 people, they're seeking after gold in the state of California. It wasn't a state yet, of course, at that point. But San Francisco, the city of San Francisco grew from just 200 people to 36,000 people in just 6 years because people are looking for this precious metal called gold. Many people throughout history have risked their lives to gain riches from precious metals like this. And Proverbs says that we can gain more from wisdom than all the jewels and metals combined. So in this life, in our life today, many people, they aim at riches and they miss out on wisdom. But if you and I, if we aim at wisdom, we will make the money that we need for this life, right? I've never met a wise person in my entire life who didn't have what they need. Of course, various levels of wealth, and yeah, some could be maybe not so well off as other people, but I've never met a wise person in my life who didn't have what they need for this life. Because wisdom, this is why we can say that wisdom is more precious than jewels, because wisdom will get you the things that you need for this life spiritually, but also shows you how to live life and navigate life so you can be provided for. So you get both of those things, I think, when you walk in the way that God wants you to walk. Now, Raymond Ortlund, he says it like this. Wisdom is skill at living life well. Money can put food on the table, but wisdom puts laughter around that table. Money can buy a house, but wisdom makes it a home. Money can buy a woman jewelry, but wisdom wins her heart. Now, money, we know that money cannot fill a home with love. You can't just take money and just infuse that into a household, and that's just not going to work. This is why, if you look, you've heard stories, I'm sure, why so many kids of, like, super wealthy parents, so many of the kids are unhappy and depressed and anxious. I mean, you've seen what happens in Hollywood families, where just crazy immense wealth, and yet just often destruction and divorce, broken family after broken family, and kids not talking to parents, and you can see what money does to a family if there's no wisdom applied to that family and there's no love in that household. So many kids can struggle for all kinds of reasons. Kids that have lots of wealth can struggle with this lack of genuine relationships. Like, does anybody truly like me for me? Or they just like me for what my family can do for them? So they can struggle there. They can struggle with isolation. You know, because there's a, if your friend group, if no one's in the same class as you, even though you're privileged, you can still feel isolated because you feel like, well, they can't really relate to me. And so it can isolate kids. There's also can be a lack of motivation with someone when they have parents that are super, super wealthy because the kids, they feel like they're already made. and they're going to get lots of wealth from mom and dad, and so they feel like, what motivation should I have to try to work hard and do for myself? And then lastly, there's absentee parents much of the time, where with wealth, there usually comes with a demanding career for a parent that can lead parents to being physically or emotionally unavailable to those kids. So here's the question that we all have to wrestle with is, do you want to be rich or do you want a life that's rich with wisdom? That's a choice you're going to have to make when it comes to what you pursue in this life. And verse 15 says that nothing you desire can compare with wisdom. So I want you to think in your mind right now, what are your greatest desires right now? Be honest with yourself. Just have this conversation with yourself right now. What are my greatest desires right now? It may not be earthly riches, but whatever we desire, these verses tell us we should seek wisdom above all of those earthly desires. Look at verse 18. She, meaning, again, Lady Wisdom, she is a tree of life to those who lay hold of her. Those who hold her fast are called blessed, or blessed. I should say blessed, I guess, right? In Proverbs, again, wisdom is personified as Lady Wisdom, and that's what's described here. And so whenever we tell you to seek wisdom, we're really talking about seeking Jesus. We cannot separate wisdom from the person of Jesus Christ. So where do you remember? This verse mentions a tree of life. Where do you remember a tree of life in the Bible? This should be easy. What book of the Bible? Tree of life. Genesis, right. So what happened there? Well, after Adam and Eve sinned by eating fruit from the tree of knowledge of good and evil, they were then banished from the garden, so they were now separated from the tree of life. And Solomon shows us here that what was lost in the Garden of Eden, this fellowship with God, closeness with God, is now made available again through wisdom, but also through Jesus Christ. So understand the connection between Jesus, knowing him, and having wisdom. And look at verse 19. It says, the Lord, by wisdom, founded the earth. By understanding, he established the heavens. By his knowledge, the deeps broke open, and the clouds dropped down the dew. Now, wisdom is not only for us, but when you think about just the creation, like how creation happened, we see God's wisdom on display when you think of how creation, how it all played out. How God created everything is a way that God displays his wisdom. So many of your scientific textbooks are going to say the universe happened by chance, but this cannot be when you examine the wisdom that's behind all of creation. In verse 20, it refers to clouds and dew, or you could also interpret that as rain. Same kind of word there. And I think we forget sometimes, like, just how amazing the miracle of rain truly is. Especially whenever we're in a Texas drought, like, you really can sense, like, we need rain. Like, we, not just, it's like a desperate feeling that we have, right? Now, we understand the science behind it today, but at times I'll think back on ancient people, and I'll think about how, man, like, a thunderstorm to an ancient person, like, the first time they ever saw one just had to be, like, the scariest experience ever, right? Like, they don't understand what's happening, and there's this lightning, and there's rain falling from the sky. And so we forget sometimes just, we know the science behind it, but we forget back then to an ancient person just how much of a miracle the whole thing seemed to be. So imagine being an ancient farmer in the Middle East many, many years ago. And if you're living out in some wilderness, distant from any lake or stream, you may have a few wells, water wells, to keep your family and animals hydrated. But just think about when those wells begin to dry up. Think about all that has to happen for those things to get refilled or for water to come to the area that you live in. So water needs to first, let's say you're by the Mediterranean, the water needs to first evaporate from the Mediterranean Sea. It's got to be carried in clouds for several hundred miles. Now, do you know how heavy water is? If 1 inch of rain were to fall on farmland in a certain area, I forget the exact measurement for this, but that would be 27 million cubic feet of water, 206 million gallons. That's 1.6 billion pounds of water for someone to get 1 inch in a certain area of a certain size. Now, again, how's all that water going to get up into the sky? Well, it does it through the process of evaporation. And it has this miraculous way of water coming out of the sea and leaving the salt behind, because the salt, of course, would kill the crops. But after some time, it all turns back into liquid form through condensation as water gathers around these tiny dust particles, and those drops become too heavy to stay in the sky. Then they fall onto the crops, but not like a waterfall would fall onto crops, because that would trample and kill the harvest. But God's designed this system where they sprinkle, sometimes sprinkle pretty hard, as billions of smaller drops fall on those crops and bring water to the earth. So like whenever I water my own grass at my house, I have to find tools that mimic rainwater. I can't just take like a fire hydrant and blast my grass. It didn't work that way, right? You got to find something that mimics, like the sprinklers that mimic rainwater. It's how we have to water our plants and our lawns. And I think we take these things for granted because we see these things frequently, but that really shouldn't take away from us marveling at God's creation. It's mentioned here, just the wisdom. And that's just one thing, just rainstorms. But there are so many systems like that where you go, man, that's God's impressive wisdom just on display. And it can cause us to worship. When you really think and meditate on that, what God does in creation, it's crazy to think about. Look at verse 21. It says, "My son, do not lose sight of these. Keep sound wisdom and discretion, and they will be life for your soul and adornment for your neck. Then you will walk on your way securely, and your foot will not stumble. If you lie down, you will not be afraid. When you lie down, your sleep will be sweet. Do not be afraid of sudden terror or of the ruin of the wicked when it comes. For the Lord will be your confidence and will keep your foot from being caught." So how do you know if you're walking in wisdom? How are you sleeping at night? When you lay down to go to sleep, are you someone that you toss and you turn and you just struggle and you can't really sleep? Because one of the blessings of wisdom is that you can sleep at night knowing you have nothing to hide, nothing ultimately to fear. Now, there are true sleep disorders. I'm not referring to that. I'm referring to when we are walking in sin, it leads to anxiety, fear, and worry. So have you ever done something that just no one else knows about, and you lie awake at night worrying and just being anxious? What if my parents find out? What if my friends find out? What if the person I'm dating finds out, and you just can't sleep? So someone who is maybe not walking in wisdom might be someone who struggles with how they sleep. So the blessing of wisdom allows you to live with a clear conscience and hopefully allows someone to sleep well at night. Now the next question, or next section here, is going to be talking about how to ensure we don't miss the blessings of wisdom. And so you look at a few verses here in verse 27. These following verses have to do with community. And as a youth pastor, every year, this happens all the time as a youth pastor in the church, really, no matter what age group you work with, but every year I see friendships that break apart. I see friendship groups come into high school, and they're friends, and then a year, 2 years later, I'm like, whatever happened to that person and that person? They're just not friends anymore, and something happened. I'm not sure what it was. But it usually results from some things you're going to see in these passages here as to why community breaks apart with certain friendship groups. Look at verse 27 where it says, "Do not withhold good from those to whom it is due when it's in your power to do it. Do not say to your neighbor, 'Go and come again tomorrow, I will give it,' when you have it with you." So the idea here is to help your needy neighbor, help your neighbor that's in need. Now, this can apply to seeing someone who's in need and refusing to help them. It can apply to that. But in that day, it's really talking about an employer who withholds wages from someone that they owe money to. So someone's done the work, but the boss won't pay. Now, I don't think any of you in here are business owners and have to owe anybody money, but we don't really get a pass here, because what are some ways that you and I can withhold good things from other people? Withhold good things from our friends? Maybe encouragement, maybe being kind in those simple ways. Maybe not holding back materially, but holding back relationally and refusing to give someone just the blessing of being in friendship with them. And we withhold that from people, and we refuse to help them in that way. So there are really two kinds of sin. There are sins of omission, which is failing to do what's good. That's what's being talked about here. Then there are sins of passivity, which is the other kind are sins of commission, which is doing evil against someone. So one kind, so sins of omission are sins of passivity, failing to do the good. Sins of commission are doing acts of evil against someone, something that this next verse talks about, verse 29. It says, do not plan evil against your neighbor who dwells trustingly beside you. Do not contend with a man for no reason when he has done you no harm. The idea is to protect your innocent neighbor. So, neighbor, someone's not done harm to you, but we have this drive in us to fight and contend against them, planning evil against them when they don't deserve anything like that whatsoever. There are people, this verse says, there are people who dwell close by and they trust us. They're our friends. And it's saying, don't take advantage of their trust and don't turn around and stab them in the back and use that trust against them. You know, there are some people that are always looking for a fight, always looking for conflict. And I think it's the only way that their life can feel exciting is if they're in some kind of drama or some kind of conflict. I'm not referring to, you know, confronting sin, like in a loving way, confronting sin in someone's life. I'm not referring to that. There's a time for that. But this is in reference to picking a fight for no reason. And this is the principle upon which all reality shows are based, because conflict sells. Can you imagine a show, a reality show, where everyone just got along, like all the time? Like, no one's gonna watch that, because conflict sells. And there are some people that they just are always in conflict and selling conflict to other people and getting people involved in their little drama and their little triangles. And what's really driving it, I think, is this fleshly desire to be the center of attention. Like, I've got to always be at the center, and I will do whatever it takes to put myself there. And so this is saying, don't be a person who is hypercritical, always looking to find fault with people. You know, recently I've been reading this book called The Anxious Generation, about halfway through it right now, and it's called, the subtitle is How the Great Rewiring of Childhood is Causing an Epidemic of Mental Illness. And I can't get into all the weeds, it's way too much to get into now, but for the adults in the room, they can probably attest that, like, maybe 10, 15 years ago, like, things changed dramatically in our culture. And I attribute a lot of it, and he does in this book. This is not a Christian writing this book, but attributes a lot of it to the advent of smartphones and social media. And it seems like we're oversimplifying that. Like, it can't just be that. It has to be something else. Look at research. It's pretty evident in a lot of people, young people especially, that mental illness went way up with the advent of living our lives predominantly online and what that brings to us. He has a chapter in the book on the harms of social media and how it affects guys and girls. So just going to ask you all a survey question, see what you think about this. What do you think the research shows? How many of you think that social media harms boys more than girls? Raise your hand. How many of you think that social media harms girls more than boys? Raise your hand. Okay. Your opinion agrees with his research, all right? So you agree with what the book says. Now, I'm not picking on the girls. I'm just showing you what he says in this book. And the first three points are going to seem like, why are you telling us this? But it does tie into the context of the whole thing. Point number four is really what I want to get to, which ties back into the passage. So the first reason he gives for why it harms girls more than boys is that he says girls are more affected by visual, social comparison, and perfectionism. So that's reason number one as to why he says it's more harmful to girls than to boys. Now, reason number two, I mean, let's be honest. A lot of guys don't care what they look like, right? That's just the reality, right? That's how it is. So, but reason number two, girls more easily share emotions and disorders. They're more public about it. And so what can happen sometimes is they begin to share things publicly, even online possibly, And then other girls hear that and they think, I think I might have that. And so it becomes this social contagion, he calls it, where even though you may not have something, like someone else may truly have that thing, whatever it is, you think you have it because someone else has that thing. And so it can lead to greater harm for girls in that way. And then point number three is that girls are just more subject to harassment online. I think that's a reality. And then number four, this is what I wanted to get to. The fourth reason he gives is that girls' aggression is often more relational. And again, this is all in his book. It's all research-based. I don't think it's biased towards one gender. I'll get to the guys in just a minute. But the reality is if guys wanna hurt someone, it's usually going to be physical or they'll insult someone face-to-face. But girls don't always do it that way. He talks about how if a girl wants to hurt another girl, what will she do? She will often hit her in her relationships by spreading gossip, often turning her friends against her. That's how it will often happen. He says that girls are four times more likely to experience cyberbullying than guys are. Because the digital world has magnified the reach and the effect of relational bullying. Now, if someone has sinned against you, there are biblical ways to handle that, but many times people are just looking for a fight and looking for conflict, looking for drama, when the other person is truly innocent. So here's the question for us. What if we all did what these verses say and we sought to protect the innocent rather than exploiting them? What if you made that simple change in your life today and said, you know what, I'm going to protect my innocent neighbor and not seek to exploit someone who's done no one any harm? If someone has done harm, there's a biblical way to handle that. But oftentimes, nothing's been done that's harmful to you. But we just want to stir up drama and conflict and make ourselves the center of attention. And so look at verse 31 here, next couple of verses. It says, do not envy a man, so we're getting to the guys now, do not envy a man of violence, and do not choose any of his ways. For the devious person is an abomination to the Lord, but the upright are in his confidence. So avoid your violent neighbor. So girls may be more prone to relational aggression, but guys may be more prone to physical aggression. Now, why would we envy the violent guy or the bully? Well, people can often fear that person, and with fear comes this sort of false respect. And this person has the power. If guys feel disrespected, they often resort to violence to try to get respect. It's like a short-circuited way of trying to get respect is I'm going to be powerful and violent, so they have to respect me. And it's unbiblical, of course, and it short-circuits what true respect really is. Example of this. I was on 31st Street a couple weeks ago. Driving down the road, going to my daughter's volleyball game, and it's like a four-lane road, so I'm in the left lane going south on 31st Street, and there's a car that just zooms around me and gets in front of me going pretty fast. He gets behind this truck, and he's trying to get around the truck, and the truck's not going very fast in his mind, so he decides to go around the truck in the turn lane. He goes in the left turn lane, goes around the truck, gets in front of the truck, and then he comes to a complete stop, just to make the guy mad. And now the guy in the truck is like honking his horn, and I'm seeing lots of different kinds of fingers come out of the windows of those cars, right? And I'm still behind this situation, and I'm just kind of following, seeing what's going to happen here. And then the car finally goes ahead, and then the truck zooms around the car in the turn lane and does the exact same thing, gets in front of the car now, and now he stops. And then the car gets next to the truck, and they're just yelling and cursing through out the window and stuff, back and forth with each other. And I'm just like, what is up with these two guys? And here's the thing. I knew it was guys. I knew it was not women doing this, right? I already knew that already, and I was right. And so we are now going down 31st Street, and now we're close to Domino's. You know where Domino's is? And I see these two vehicles pull into the parking lot, okay? And so I did what any good American would do. I pulled into the parking lot as well, all right? And I pulled in there to see what was going to happen. So I go in there, and And so this couple gets out of the truck, a man and a woman get out of the truck, and the guy in the car, he sees them in the parking lot. He tries to run them over in the parking lot, and they move out of the way. Then he pulls around. He gets out of his car and starts yelling and cursing at the other guy. They start sparring like they're going to have a fist fight in the parking lot. And at this point, I did what any good American would do. I pulled out my phone, and I hit record. Now, I wasn't trying to go viral. I was gathering evidence in case I had to testify, and that is the honest truth, okay? Now, they start about to go at it, and then a funny but not so funny moment is one guy, the guy who started the whole thing, he runs back to his car and pretends to get something out of his car and has his hand hidden, is running across the parking lot like he has a gun, okay? Running at the couple full speed. And they're just sitting the guy, looking at the guy, laughing at this guy like, you don't have a gun, just stop it, you know? And he finally, like, realizes he has no, he can't resort to anything here at this point. So he just kind of drops it and, like, runs back to his car and drives off like a coward, the coward that he truly is, all right? And so I see this whole thing unfold, and I'm just thinking, like, what an embarrassment. What an embarrassment. These two grown men are about to go at it in some parking lot, don't even know each other, over a guy going too slow down the street. That's what we're fighting about. But what can happen, though, is I would imagine that for these two men, that wasn't the first time those kinds of things have happened, right? There are some people that just want to live kind of this violent life. But to be honest, both men looked completely foolish. I think it's a great reminder of the truth of this verse that you avoid the violent person because no one wins when you're caught up in that formula. It is a lose-lose situation every time. And so the words of Proverbs, avoid your violent neighbor. And then the last section here is the last couple of verses. How can we stay motivated? Because when you're talking about the blessings of wisdom, how can you stay motivated that wisdom truly is the way to go? Look at these verses here. Last couple of verses. The Lord's curse is on the house of the wicked, but he blesses the dwelling of the righteous. Toward the scorners he is scornful, but to the humble he gives favor. The wise will inherit honor, but fools get disgrace. Another way to phrase verse 34 is that God opposes the proud but gives grace to the humble. It may seem like the prideful and the foolish, the violent, are the ones who are winning in this life. But God is going to judge. This verse is clear about that. God's going to judge that if they don't come to know Christ. He opposes the proud is what it says here. But let's not forget the second part of that verse. But he also gives grace to the humble. So we stay motivated by remembering and reflecting on the cross of Jesus. Because Jesus turned the violence of this world upside down and subjected himself to the greatest of fools so he could offer salvation to fools like you and me. You guys are going to head to your breakouts. So if you don't know where to go, usually freshman girls over here, sophomore girls over here.